This is a download from the Scottish Railway Preservation Society.
Just putting some lights on the engine now. We've got two lights showing it's a passenger train.
This is Soundworks, the magazine for railway enthusiasts around the world, coming to you from Bowness in Scotland.
Hello and welcome to Soundblast Programme 6. In the spring edition of Blast Bite, the splendid quarterly magazine of the Scottish Railway Preservation Society, we were promised a special edition of Sound Blast featuring an extensive interview with author Bill Avis on the work of the ROD, the Railway Operating Division in general, and of the service of the North British Railway Company's No. 673 MOD in particular. Well, the promised date of the middle of March has come and gone. But the promise of an interview with Bill Avis is about to be kept right now. For roving reporter David Bytheway caught up with Bill and talked with him about his recently published book, When Railways Went to War.
Bill, why was the Railway Operating Division formed?
Well, I think the best way of describing this is to say that before the First World War broke out, the British Army had some experience of the use of railways in war, particularly during the Boer War, and they had two types of military personnel ready to operate railways. The first one was that they had a special couple of companies of Royal Engineers who were trained really in the civil engineering aspects of building and railways, and they also had a number of officers who were had been seconded to the major railway companies who were experts on programming the movement of troops by rail and, for example, being prepared after staff talks with the French for deploying the British Expeditionary Force by rail from the Channel ports when they arrived in France. So that started it off. But basically, the arrangements were that the French were committed to what was called, what we would now call, host nation support. In other words, they were going to provide all the infrastructure for any Allied troops which joined them in any conflict. However, by the end of 1915, there are two particular things that happened. One is that the British had found that the need to develop facilities at the Channel ports and depots and things like that, and leading up to railheads where supplies were delivered to troops, they found that it was a disadvantage relying on an Allied power rather than providing these services themselves. Actually, particularly in the early part of 1916, with the battles of the Somme and the long campaign around Verdun, the French railways were really on their last legs and were finding it very difficult to supply even their own people. And as a result, the British Expeditionary Force needed their own railway lines and their own people operating them. And this was why, in addition to the construction companies, the railway construction companies which we'd started the war with, the Royal Engineers started a railway operating organization called the Railway Operating Division, and it was mainly formed from soldiers who were actually railwaymen who had joined up as volunteers when war broke out. First stage of this was that during 1915, a number of railwaymen and a few British locomotives were used at places like Boulogne to work the British traffic from the docks. And gradually, by the end of 1915, beginning of 1916, the French had asked the British to start running one or two of the lines in immediately behind the British, the railway lines immediately behind the British front, particularly in the area around Ypres. And so it went on. During 1916, the crisis in the French railways was so bad that the number of steps were taken to investigate precisely what sort of support the BEF required from the railways, and there was a terrific expansion, and both of the, what were called the RCCs, the Railway Construction Companies, the ROCs, the Railway Operating Companies, and also the new thing that came in was the War Department Light Railways of narrow gauge tracks, which could be laid much nearer the front. And that's how it all started. So the Railway Operating Division was formed in 1915. It didn't really come into its own until the middle of 1916, but by the end of the war it employed, I think I'm right in saying, about 18,000 troops.
So Maud was one of the engines which was sent to France in 1917.
Yeah,
now,
right.
She's a North British loco, a goods loco. Have you been able to discover something about its duties?
First of all, there were, as I said before, a few tank engines were taken over from the southeastern Chatham to Boulogne. The War Office ordered a number of what were called switchers, really, from the Baldwin Locomotive Works in America in 1916. But then, with the big expansion, several things happened. First of all, the War Office requisitioned well over 500 locomotives from the British mainline companies. They ordered a lot more larger locomotives from the Baldwin Locomotive Works in America and from the Canadian Locomotive Works in Ontario. And they also started to order what a very well-known, what we people afterwards knew as the ROD 280s, which were the British Great Central 280 Robinson design, of which over 500 were built. Now, the North British Railway was one of the British companies which provided requisitioned engines. There were 25 of the their C-class, of which Marne was one. They were actually almost the last of the requisitioned engines to arrive in France in October-November 1917, but they were very well received. As the Scottish railway enthusiasts in particular would know, that these engines, which had originally were a Holmes design of the 1880s, most of them had by the mid-1910s been rebuilt and were virtually brand new engines, and they were regarded as very capable and also had plenty of protection in around their cabs and things like that, and they were a very useful design. We know a little bit about what the North British Railway engines did. After arriving in France in at the autumn of the winter of 1917-18, they were first of all based at Audrique, which was the biggest BEF logistics centre outside Calais. They shortly afterwards moved on to a place called Berg, which was just south of Dunkirk. But by February, March 1918, nearly all of them were actually at a place called Verquignoy near Béthune, where the French coal fields were. Although it was very close to the French front line, most of the collieries were still working, and in fact, the North British Railways engines were largely used on moving French coal traffic, at least at the beginning. More after that, we don't really have much detail of what they were used for.
David, by the way, was talking with Bill Evers. When Railways Went to War is published by Sean Tyas Publishing, an imprint of Paul Watkins, 1 High Street, Donnington, Lincolnshire, PE11 4TA at £24.95. Its ISBN is 1-900-289-997. Authorised for construction from 1902, the first movements date from 1903, when an 18-inch, well, 457mm if you will, an 18-inch gauge tramway was laid to assist in removing 70 corrugated iron huts from Longmoor Military Camp to Morden. The railway was relayed to 4 foot 8.5-inch, 1,435mm, the standard gauge in 1905 to 1907, and was initially known as the Woolmer Instructional Military Railway. It was renamed the Longmoor Military Railway in 1935. As a training railway, it was often being constructed or deconstructed. The layout would often change, and at one time housed a machine which could lay 1,500 yards of track a day. That's 1,400 metres. At its peak, the railway ran to over 70 miles, or 110 kilometres, of operational track and sidings. With the declining military role for railways, it was inevitable that the significance of the LMR would be reduced in later years. Passenger services were withdrawn in 1957, although the movement of goods continued for the further 12 years before Longmoor Military Railway closed down on the 31st October 1969. A number of Longmoor Military Railway personnel went on to have distinguished careers in the railway industry, including the SRPS's very own Stuart Seller.
I was conscripted in January 1956, and I went to Longmoor in April 56. When I was at school, I was in this combined cadet force, and that was so that I could get into the engineers. I had a better chance of getting into the engineers, and I wasn't wanting to be called up into the Royal Scots and be part of the infantry, particularly not so long after the Korean confrontation had finished. But I didn't go to Longmoor immediately. I went to Worcester for military training for 2 weeks, and then to Farnborough for 12 weeks of field engineer training, which was sheer hell. And after Farnborough, I went to Longmoor, initially in movement control for trade training, but I made the mistake of grabbing a rifle and making a name for myself in the Longmoor Rifle Association meeting. And the 2IC of the regiment, the 16 Railway Training Regiment, Royal Engineers at Longmoor, said, "You're not leaving Longmoor, you're staying here." So they found me a sinecure in the locomotive department, and that allowed me to go on all my practices and competitions with the 2.2 training, 0.22 rifle shooting training in the winter, and the 303, including Bisley, in the summer.
Mm-hmm. But you were there really to learn about railways and railways, how railways operated. Can you tell us what actually you learned there?
I learned a lot there because the Longmoor covered all sorts of trades, from permanent way to signalling to operating, and movement control, of course, was more on the commercial side. But when you were on guard duty at Longmoor, as you had to do periodically, you were involved in all sorts of other duties on the permanent way department and the operating. When you were running trains, you had to learn about the guards' duties, shunters' duties, and they didn't call them signalmen, they called them blockmen.
What sort of operation did they run at Longmoor? Was it very big?
Yeah, they had a passenger railway and they had a freight railway. And it had a strategic importance in itself, because the passenger railway ran between Liss on the Waterloo-Guildford-Portsmouth line and Borden, which was a branch from the Woking-Aldershot to Bentley Junction line. And the freight traffic was fed to the railway from each end of the line, and the military railway itself had shunting engines diagrammed to work the various stores depots each side of Longmoor Down station itself at Oakhanger, Liss Forest, and Weaversdown. And these two steppers had to be shunted, so that was good training for people that needed the training practically. And the railway at Longmoor, the Longmoor Military Railway, was split up into all sorts of sections, which could be signalled in such a way that you could learn the various methods of working, single line working, with staff and token, with tablet instruments, double line, permissive block, absolute block. Different methods of working from one end to the other, and that allowed the training to be carried out for staff, which was of good value. It wasn't a mirror image of the British Railways signalling practice, but it was very close to it. And of course the Motive Power Department had steam locomotives, and when I was there introduced diesel locomotives as well, for shunting in particular. And the footplate staff were able to learn steam and diesel. I've just mentioned the goods service, but the passenger service operated between Borden, Longmoor and Liss. And the bit from Longmoor to Liss was more heavily used by the troops than the bit from between Longmoor and Borden, because the train service from Liss to London was a half-hourly service, still is, I think. And the trains that ran between Longmoor and Liss were called the Bullet. So when you were counting the days until your demobilisation, as most national servicemen did, it was so many months, so many days, a breakfast and the 10-10 Bullet.
To get out. What's the biggest difference between running a military railway and civilian railways?
Well, you're subject to military discipline, and you had to dress in a certain way. You had to fall in parade before you went to your various duties in a certain way. But it was a bit more relaxed in many senses, because if you're on back shift in the locomotive department, you were excused parades in the morning and you just reported to the depot for work. But the uniform itself consisted of denim blues for the footplate staff, denims for the shunters, and instead of having green blanco belt and gaiters, you had black belt and gaiters, which was much easier to look after given the hostile environment in which you were working with railway wagons, shunting poles and on the ground.
Do you think the country was right when it actually wound up the railway operations at Longmoor?
I think so, yes, because railways have a minor role now in any theatre of war.
And that pretty well wraps up this special edition of Sound Blast. You can contact us online at www.srps.org.uk/soundblast, all lowercase. That's www.srps.org.uk/soundblast. Or you can write to us at soundblast, two words this time with initial capitals, soundblast, SRPS, Union Street, Bowness, West Lothian, EH519AQ, Scotland. The interviewer, editor and producer has been David Bytheway. And I'm Sandy Simpson, wishing you all that you wish yourself from everyone here at the Scottish Railway Preservation Society at Bowness in Scotland.